Tom, I realize it's 10:35. We're 5 minutes over, so I am waiting for one more individual to join in, but I can take care of that through the presentation. So let's, I'll concede to you.
Okay, that's rare. Okay, we're now going to reconvene for agenda item 4. This is the discussion of the board's authority and constraints on climate change policy. John Tokarczyk will be the main presenter on this. So John, we'll turn it over to you.
Chair Imeson, members of the board, State Forester Dougherty. I'm John Tokarczyk, Acting Planning and Analysis Program Director. Along with me today, virtually, are Danny Norlander, Forest Carbon and Health Analyst, and Matt DeBoer from the Department of Justice. The topic at hand is an initial step in what is a significant climate and carbon board work plan. Sorry, thank you. And today we are asking for a determination and approval of board questions that can inform and address the board's authority and constraints relative to forest climate and carbon policy. Given the nature of the subject and subsequent legal analysis that will follow, Matt is present to listen and provide thoughts where he's able, but will not be able to provide analysis today. On the other hand, Danny can provide all manner of perspective and has prepared a background and an initial set of questions that should be supportive in the board's deliberation. With that, I'll turn it over to Danny.
Good morning, Chair Imeson, members of the board, State Forest Authority. For the record, I am Danny Norlander. I serve as the Forest Carbon and Forest Health Policy Analyst at this time, and I put together this presentation for us to go through some preliminary questions that have been put together for you. Let's go ahead and slide. There we go. Okay, so just as a refresher, our climate change work plan is kind of broken into two different topics. We have the first topic, which is analysis of the statutes and administrative rules. And topic B is mitigation and adaptation efforts. So there are a number of steps that will take place in this. Click. So today we're going to be looking at assessing the statutory authority, which is kind of that first block, and once more. And really we're just looking at, this first bullet today. So identifying the primary questions of interest. And this is an opportunity for the board to really outline what their questions are in regards to their statutory authority. And we need to identify those questions so we can pose them to DOJ, which is that next bullet, and then we can proceed down the list there. So next slide. So today we're going to present some potential questions that we've drafted up and reviewed through the department. The board can have discussion on their questions or the questions that are posed. And then we will have some final clarification questions that we'll pose to the Department of Justice, and public comment will be in there as well. So go ahead with the next slide. So today's outcomes, the department would like to see at the end a set of questions we can provide to the Department of Justice, with clear expectations and a timeline kind of laid out for that. As John stated a few moments ago, today is not getting legal advice from DOJ. We're merely generating the questions that we will pose to DOJ, and that will in turn be answered later on by them. So if you have kind of mechanistic questions or questions about how the process will go, we can ask Matt those, but nothing that would be specific legal advice from them today. Slide. So to start, the summary background and analysis was mostly included in the board work plan. So or the staff report that was provided. So the summary is basically, as I was talking about, the The board has expressed interest, the summary and background is that the board has expressed interest in what their statutory authority is over the last year or so that I've been in this position. And a lot of that has come down to what can and can't be done within the statutes that the board has. So go ahead and next slide. I think with that, we can get into the questions. So all these questions, I'll go through the process on how these were developed real quick so you have an idea, and then we can look at each question. If you have questions as we're going along, there are four questions that, four blocks that were posed. We can discuss them at the end as a block, or we can do them individually. I'll leave that up to you, Tom, if you want to make that decision either way. So the questions were raised by going through our statutes and kind of identifying where the board has expressed interest and expressed questions and going through old notes and board minutes and seeing where that kind of lines up with what statute is in place and seeing where there may or may not be questions that could arise based on what the interest has been. None of these have been posed to DOJ at this time. They've been provided them as with everybody, but they haven't had a chance to do any analysis on them, kind of waiting for the board to weigh in, because I really see these as the board's questions to DOJ, not so much the department's questions, but how are we going to get these kind of outlined and figured out long term? So. With that, the first questions set of questions is, does the board have the authority to supervise all matters of forest policy and management, including establishing climate change and forest carbon goals? So that's more related to what the board can do in 526.016. And then the second part of that is carbon storage and sequestration included in management of all forest lands in Oregon should be encouraged to provide continuous production of all forest benefits. So that's kind of getting to, is carbon and forest carbon specifically a forest benefit that we need to, that the board can regulate? So Tom, do you have a preference on if we do this individually or at the end?
Why don't we take questions kind of as we go through?
Okay, sounds good, Peter. So I thought Joe's hand go up.
Chair Imason, I guess I have a question related to this. This question, are we implying or including all benefits of forest carbon in this question? Obviously trees store carbon, but also forest products store carbon. Should we expand this question to get clarity related to those how Oregon, Oregon is very unique in its ability to store carbon both in growing trees and also storing as forest products. Is that the intent of this question, just from my own understanding?
I think the intent for this question was more related to forest benefits in the woods, because after it leaves the woods, it would be more harvested wood products. If you want it to be, like I was saying, these are your questions. So,
I would be interested. Obviously, in my mind, forest benefits also include forest products. Our forests have a unique ability to, to store carbon in the form of forest products also, and replace, other building materials of higher carbon usage. So I guess I'm interested in that. Is that really a part of this? So that's, I guess I would like that to be added, obviously the benefit of trees, and I mean, we store carbon with trees, obviously, and growing of trees. But also we also store, our forests can store carbon in the form of forest products.
And I've got several hands up, and excuse me, I'm not as good as knowing whose question popped up first. So, I'm going to say, I know Brenda has a question and then Jim has a question. So why don't we, have those questions, they may be on the same topic, and we can discuss this. So Brenda?
Yeah, one quick comment and then one question. To Joe's point, I think carbon stores and forest products is good to be added, but I would encourage that it be the net carbon stores after carbon emissions have been deducted from those products. The question, though, deals with the rationale if the statute is to maximize benefits. And maybe, Danny, I apologize if you're going to cover this in a future slide, but climate change not only mitigation measures could be viewed as a benefit, but climate change itself is also a constraint on maximizing benefits. And so I'm wondering if there's some way, maybe in this question or a future one, to consider how we must consider climate change in order to maximize benefits now and on into the future.
And Jim?
To Joe's point, in terms of carbon storage and building products, et cetera, I think that really needs to be a separate question because potentially legally that gets quite expansive and probably could potentially go far beyond what would otherwise be reasonably thought of as part of a Board of Forestry's authority. So I think it's a good question, but I would like it to be a separate question.
And I guess if our purpose is to determine what kinds of questions we want to ask the board to understand what our authority and constraints are, I guess one of my questions associated with this, I'm not sure about this yet, but you've got the question and you've got the rationale. So I have the question I have around the rationale is, does the board need to make a finding or declare a policy around this, or have we already done that such that we could then include climate specifically in terms of our is there some step we need to take, I guess, to establish that authority? And that would be, I think, useful to have. In other words, I guess, what is the constraint that I guess that we're trying to deal with? Are we constrained from doing any of this, or are we covered under the rationale as it exists without taking any further action? Does that make any sense?
Tom, this is Peter, and yes, that does. And this is, checking that, yes, in fact, is this a, the legislature gives functions to the Board of Forestry in a sense through statutes. And, to me, this one implies since you're doing you supervise all matters of forest policy, and then the term production of all forest benefits, might imply that that's meant to really be fully encompassing. And so, just to get clarification, are we interpreting that correctly? Because the board has set goals for forest carbon in the forest program for Oregon. So it's to get at that question. And then if it turns out, no, this is really limiting, then I think this next question would be what would be the steps we would take if you want to be able to weigh in. And that would be if a statute limits you, then it would be a statutory change. So I think these are seeing if the authority is already there.
Right.
Or is there a constraint?
Right.
The way we would ask DOJ to do their analysis. Am I getting at what you were asking?
Yeah, I think that you are. And I think in trying to come up with and framing the questions, what we want to do is basically find out, again, this isn't doing an action here today. This is making sure that the board understands what its the legal underpinnings are or aren't for actions that would, for policies that it's interested in discussing further, right? Because we want to make sure that in doing this that we've, if there are what appears to be legal impediments, that we understand what those are. So I guess I don't know that today, I think I do know that today we probably don't, we're not going to have a discussion about every policy matter. We ought to be talking about where we need DOJ to look at some issues to understand what we can and can't do under our existing authorities and policies, right?
Okay. That's correct. And, you know, and I made the point that it was already pretty clear we have the authority to establish a carbon offset program.
Right.
You know, so there's no reason to ask that question. It's clearly stated in the statutes in general for the state forester and then specifically for state forests as well. So in some of our, there's a clear nexus for climate policy within the statutes. In other ones, we want to make sure. Going back to Joe's question about forest products, as Danny said, we were kind of thinking about the forest ecosystem carbon. But when you think about the Climate Committee, UN, IPCC.
Yeah.
The IPCC protocol recognizes two pools of forest carbon. One is forest ecosystem and the other pool is, harvested wood products. And so I think we could expand this question because there are two different types of benefits. And we'll work with, DOJ to see if, you know, in terms of, whether we should have it as one question or break it into two. So I don't think we need to solve that problem today. And, in terms of Brenda's questions, I think that's really good. We always try to do a net carbon storage based on the IPCC protocol.
Okay.
And Joe has a question.
Well, I'll just that's great. I think breaking it out, getting clear. I'm just looking for clarity there. It's to Jim's point, and I'm fine with all that discussion. I just want to make sure that we somehow get, you know, DOJ's opinion on forest products. So, but that's great. I think my question has been answered. Thank you.
Okay. And I see that Nils and Brenda both have hands up here. So Brenda, is yours a continuation of the question you were asking? Why don't you go ahead and then we'll come to Nils.
Yeah, two points. I'm afraid my comments maybe not have been understood correctly. First of all, the net carbon stored in wood products is not considered unless the transportation and processing emissions are deducted from that. And my understanding from past discussions is that's not the case. So maybe a misunderstanding what has been done, but I think that needs to be clarified. The other point I want to make is coming back to my other question. The question that, as it's written here, talks about establishing climate change and forest carbon goals, when in fact one part of that question is, should we be considering climate change when setting policy such that climate change will constrain our ability to attain those goals in the future?
And so is that the legal question you want explored related to that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
We've been told when we were talking about the Siskiyou rules that we were not to be thinking about climate change as a factor when designing those rules, when in fact climate change will have an effect on our ability to maintain water quality standards in the future.
Okay. And for me, I just, again, there's a policy question of whether we should do that. And what we're trying to get at is not the policy question, is there a legal impediment to that? And is that what you're trying to explore here?
Are we legally allowed to consider climate change as a constraint on achieving goals in the future when we set policy?
Yeah, and that'll come up, I think, in the third question.
Yeah. Okay.
But I have this written down as a new question, Brenda.
Okay. And I see Nils with a hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of add on to, I think, the discussion I'm hearing from Brenda, and then Peter, clarification. I mean, I do think this, that we would want to look at this in a holistic systems way that's looking at, you know, net contributions or deficits in carbon through the system. And I think, as Andrew Yost has presented to us a couple times, it's important we try to tier to the IPCC approach so that there's some consistency and the use of the accepted and sort of internationally accepted methods of doing this, unless we have strong reason to believe that we can do it better. But I'm inclined to go with that IPCC model and the two pools and really think about and make sure, and I'm not an expert in it, but make sure that it is, you know, accounting for all the additions and subtractions in carbon, but also, as we know from the Western U.S. versus Eastern U.S. and Europe, et cetera, thinking about offsets of emissions and offsets from the alternative building products that may or may not be used, or offsets in wildfire from doing fuel reduction work and trying to utilize that material effectively. To me, all of that's important, and it obviously becomes complicated, and that's why I think it's important we try to use some accepted systems and models and calculations to do that. But it certainly needs to be both the forest pool and the external or wood products pool.
Okay. And Brenda, I think you, I'm assuming you've got another comment.
Just to follow up on Nils's comment, being consistent with the, regional protocols through IPCC is fine, and I encourage that. I think it does provide some consistency. But on the other hand, those protocols do not necessarily consider the carbon costs associated with producing those products. So we could do both, and there's really no reason why we shouldn't do both if we feel that one is going to give us a better sense for what the net carbon stores are in those products.
Right. Okay, and Cindy.
Just kind of a follow-up on that discussion. I think that's sort of a policy decision that the board will have to make in future to whether or not that's an element they want to consider. I obviously, if I were still here in the future, would concur with Brenda that it's an important element. For the purposes of today's discussion, I think we need to find out from DOJ if there are any legal constraints and or authorities for us to include a consideration of the carbon costs associated with the transport when we're talking about carbon storage in the wood products. So, you know, the discussion of whether that's an element that the board wants to include in its deliberations in future is a policy question. We need to find out from DOJ if there's any legal constraint / authority for that consideration.
Right. And I would really underscore your point, because I think there can be a tendency to want to discuss or debate the issue about how we do this. And what we're really trying to do is make sure we understand the legal framework, to do what the board intends to do in the future, so we don't run up unwittingly against a legal issue somewhere down the road on this, for those who are discussing it.
This is Peter, Tom. I mean, that's great. And these are really good discussions and good questions. And about the methods of how you calculate carbon. And I don't think there's a legal question here about the methods. This is really a policy question and a methods question. And we are not only following the IPCC, we've joined the Western states in the memorandum of understanding so that we would have a consistent policy from California through Washington. And we're also coordinating with a multi-agency research group to look at these kind of very questions. And we've reported a little bit on that. We will be reporting more as we go forward. There'll be a time for these kind of methodology questions. But I think that, how we actually measure it isn't part of the legal question. The legal question is, can we count it as a forest benefit?
Right. And I'm a little concerned that I'm trying to kind of move this along to see the next questions. Cindy, do you have another comment on this though?
Just sort of a follow up. If we're asking if we have legal authority to look at, and manage, and regulate proposed policies and adopt rules associated with carbon storage, on forest carbon on the landscape and in the wood products, I think we ought to include in that question, whether we also have the legal authority to consider the carbon costs associated with harvest and transportation. The policy discussion and decision of the board in future about whether or not they want to include it is a separate thing, but I suspect that question will be debated. And so since we're already proposing to ask the legal question of whether we have the authority on forest carbon in the trees and in the forest products, we might as well at the same time also ask if we have the authority to consider the carbon costs in harvest and transportation. Right.
So if there are legal impediments to that. So,
yeah.
Can we move on then?
Yes. Next slide. So question two is, does the board have the authority to regulate forest carbon under the Forest Practices Act? And that comes about because we need to determine if the duties and the powers of the board to make rules provide for maintenance of resources, including forest carbon and or climate change. So I think that this question is kind of getting to some of what the conversation was.
This is a really important, I agree. I think this is a lot of the discussion we just had really would fit under this, this question.
Yeah. So this one, and I think actually the next one also will kind of get into some of the conversation that was just had. We start off with a real broad one. Can the board supervise or take climate change into account for making carbon goals? And is carbon a forest benefit that the board can regulate? So then we get a little bit more specific to the Forest Practices Act. And I do want to step back real quick and talk about the work plan again. So we had the whole list of all of the bulleted points there, and some of those are dealing more with each specific policy and rule within the FPA and within protection within state forests also. So that's another process that will take place later on in the work plan. So doing an assessment and analysis of all of the rules and everything that are in place in relation to climate change. And that may be things that also came about in the discussion that we just had. So this one is specific to the Forest Practices Act under 527.710. And those statutes are where these questions kind of came up, but it could be much broader than that. It could apply to the entirety of the Forest Practices Act, or it could be more specific.
Right. Okay. Cindy, your hand is up.
Yeah, I like this question, both in its general focus and Well, I like the question. I'm wondering if we need sort of a companion overarching question that covers the adaptation part of climate change management. This is sort of the mitigation. Do we have the authority to regulate carbon storage and carbon emissions associated with forest practices? I think there's a similar kind of question of, do we have the authority to manage in order to increase forest resilience in the face of future climate change, just as a broad general thing? I know the next question kind of speaks to that, but I'm thinking in terms of, you know, do we have the authority, for instance, to identify and establish rules to protect climate refuges? That's more on the adaptation end of things. So I think we need to make sure we deal both with mitigation, you know, carbon issues and ecological resilience issues in an overarching and broad perspective.
Okay. I don't see other comments or questions.
So next slide then. So this one is specific more to the 714 analysis that take place. So can the board adopt forest practice rules based on future projections or models, or does there need to be a measurable degradation currently? So this kind of gets to the idea of, we know that climates are changing. We have models and projections that kind of outline that and show that. Can we take those into account when the board is in rulemaking processes, or do we have to have something that's measurable today? All right.
Okay.
So next question then. And this one is specific to the Good Neighbor Authority. So the Good Neighbor Authority lists specific outcomes for pursuing projects. So does this specifically does this apply to climate change projects as well? There's a list of them in there. Is climate change and forest carbon included in there? Or is it one that is one where it would be more broad and we would need to specify with the Forest Service more clearly?
And Jim Kelly has a question or comment.
Yeah, I actually wanted to go back to the last question. I'm being picky here, but the question does not include the point that we're talking about climate in the actual question of climate change. So I'd just like to see that question clarified to make sure that we know what the question's about.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you, Jim.
You got that, Danny?
Yeah, I'm just taking some notes as we go through.
So question four, just to give you a little bit different background, these two statutes were passed subsequently to each other. And it's sort of a question. One gives the board broad authority around the types of management goals we can do under shared stewardship in the Federal Forest Restoration Program. And the other one has very specific requirements of where we should focus one of the tools. And so there's potentially a conflict there. While the board might be able to set a broad policy to consider climate change in federal forest restoration, the one tool may be focused for very specific goals. So we just want to see if there's and it wouldn't be a conflict between the statutes. It's just limiting one of the tools from achieving one of the goals the board could set. And so we wanted clarification around that.
Okay. So those are the questions you had in the material, right, Danny?
Sir. Correct. Those are the ones that were included. So we can go on to the next slide. Jim still has his hand up. I don't know if that was.
Well, I guess I want to say, I just want to make sure that nobody had something else that wasn't on the list that they is an area that they think ought to be included. Is there Jim, I see your hand still up. Is that because you're muted, but your hand is up?
Oh, okay. I'm not sure why my hand is still up, and I'm trying to figure out how to.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Tom?
Yeah.
So we do have two new questions that have been added through the discussion that I have that we can work on.
Okay.
One was from Brenda, how, you know, must we consider climate change in achieving the maximizing of benefits? You know, not just can we set goals for what benefits we want to maximize, but do we have the authority to consider it? And then Cindy's question, which was new, is do we have the authority to identify and protect climate refuges, and ecological resilience? So I've got those down, and we'll work those questions into the request to DOJ, if that's what. Just to be clear, we sort of have six questions now.
Right. Okay. Good. That's great.
Okay.
Okay, Annie.
All right. Next slide, please. So again, on to recommendation and accepts. So click. So the board or department's recommendation is providing questions outlined to the Department of Justice for statutory review and analysis. Click. Limit the questions to the board's rulemaking ability in relation to climate change, given what is currently known and what is projected into the future. Next. And further analysis of rules will be considered as outlined in the climate change work plan, just as a reminder. So next step, click. Staff will work with the Department of Justice to obtain answers to the desired statutory authority questions. Next. The Department of Justice will present their findings to the board at a later board meeting. We're not exactly sure which meeting that will be, but it will be in this calendar year, I suspect. Analysis of current rules and statutes related to the FPA protection and state forests can commence once the DOJ clarification and answers have been obtained.
And Jim has his hand up.
Yeah, I do. I just want to make the point that, yes, you're correct, that we have been talking about getting clarification from the DOJ for a full year. And I've been surprised that it's taken us this long to get to this point where we are ready to ask the question. And so I just want to make the statement that it's time to move along and to push the DOJ to get this done and get this done quickly, and I see no reason why this should get pushed out, not back in front of us until the end of the year. So just expressing my displeasure about how long this has taken and wanting to see us move as quickly as possible and push the DOJ to get there and get these questions into them as soon as possible. Thanks.
All right. Any other, Danny, I mean, my sense is this is not you've gotten the direction that you wanted to get, and we don't need a formal board action on this. Is that what you're thinking, you and Peter, or did you want
Danny, do you have the recommendation there?
Yeah, so can we go back a couple? So our recommendation was that we provide questions that we have outlined today to DOJ for statutory review and analysis. I think it would be helpful for us to go through the questions. I can just read them quickly. And there may be some wordsmithing that takes place to incorporate some of the comments that were made, and then incorporate the two additional questions. And then have a vote that those are the questions that you guys would like.
That's fine.
Opposed to DOJ. So.
As long as you can wordsmith the questions, especially I would assume you want to have some conversation with DOJ about the questions themselves. And if they've got questions about the questions, then we're, not getting very far. Yeah.
Yeah. So, on the next steps, the timeline and stuff, I am anticipating that we will be able to get the questions to the DOJ pretty quickly, probably within the next, 2 weeks. They could have them in hand and start working on them. So that's just kind of the timeline that I'm thinking about when they would be able to get them.
Okay.
So go ahead and go to the next slide.
So I see Cindy's hand up. So Cindy, or Brenda's hand up.
That's okay. I was just ready to make a motion, but if we've got public comment on this, we're not ready for that.
Okay. Brenda.
Danny, if the DOJ will have them within 2 weeks, any sense from DOJ about how long it will take to get a response?
So conversation with DOJ indicates it would probably take about 2 months to complete the whole process and review process that they have internally. So after they get them, it'd probably be about 2 months.
I just want to echo Jim's frustration that it's taking so long to get clarity on this.
Okay, back to you, Danny. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the extent of our presentation. So public comment, and then we could come back for clarifying conversation, and then maybe we could have a vote after that.
So I think, the motion would be that we direct staff to complete the questions that we've discussed today and submit them to DOJ with the request and that submission that the work, I mean, obviously they've got processes they need to undertake. And we haven't given anything to DOJ yet. So, I understand the frustration, but it's not, DOJ hasn't had something from us, to this point. So, that we asked them to develop, responses and with all deliberate speed, or something to that effect, and then provide them to the board. The answers to the board to those questions. So if somebody wants to move something like that or modify that somehow, that's fine, but that will help us move forward.
That seems great. We want to go to public comment now?
Or do we have public comment? I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So let's take the, Hillary, can you manage the public comment again?
Yes, we have 4 members of the public signed up for item 4 today. Everyone who's in the Zoom queue who's providing testimony in real time will be listed in your attendees window in the Zoom, and will be called on in sequential order. And for those on the line, thank you very much for being ready to provide oral testimony today for the Evaluating Board's Authority and Constraints on Climate Change. We have a limited amount of time, so each of you are allotted 3 minutes. A timer will be displayed to track your time on Zoom, and I'll inform you when your time's up. So to help us stay on track, I'll announce the names in the order who signed in today, and then call on each of you one at a time. And for all of those providing the testimony, please state your full name for the record before you begin. First, in the order, we'll have Samantha Kropp, John Talbert, Maria Sasse, and David Tweet. And I will go ahead and begin with Samantha, but let me go ahead and share my screen so I can get you your time. One moment. Samantha, your time starts now.
Thank you. Chair Emison, members of the board, and State Forester Doherty, my name is Samantha Kropp, Wild and Working Forest Campaign Manager for the Center for Sustainable Economy. Governor Brown's recent executive order number 2004 gave the Oregon Department of Forestry a clear directive to use any and all of its authority to take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But despite these obligations, the ODF's report to address this EO was inadequate in substance, insufficient in tangible targets, and absent of a clear public process for engagement. Goal G of the Forestry Plan for Oregon, the board's strategic policy document, reads, quote, improve carbon sequestration and carbon storage and reduce carbon emissions in Oregon's forests and forest products, end quote. While this goal was adopted in 2015 and the board reaffirmed its commitment to it in 2019, no material steps toward climate smart forestry have been taken. Many community members share in the frustration that we just heard expressed by some board members about how long the timeline has been and how little has been accomplished. We believe that in order to meaningfully achieve the directives outlined in the EO and the board's strategic plan, the board should explore its statutory authority to truly advance climate smart forestry on state lands by, one, halting ongoing clear-cut practices that are currently transitioning healthy carbon-safe forests into unstable carbon sinks, two, restoring young unhealthy plantations into climate smart and stable forests, and three, adopting climate smart, science-backed, and site-specific management alternatives to direct state forest management in the future. In 2021 alone, Oregon Department of Forestry's operating plans would result in an additional 5,932 acres of clear cuts on the landscape, which reflects a management direction that would continue to prioritize short rotation clear cut style logging practices and further degrade forest lands. For 13 years, these future clear cuts will not only fail to sequester carbon, but will also serve as net emissions, releasing more CO2 from logging decay and the combustion of logging residuals than can be sequestered by young seedlings that take the place of that forest. I'd also like to express my support for the board's focus on climate adaptation measures in addition to the mitigation measures. We have science-backed studies, including many recent science-backed studies, demonstrating clearly that clear-cut practices reduce the resiliency of forest lands to climate impacts. Clear-cuts reduce water quality and water flow, with recent watershed studies finding supplies to be reduced by 50% or more with the transference of healthy watersheds to tree plantations. We also know that clear-cuts increase wildfire risk and contribute to the problem of climate change on a huge scale. So the Board of Forestry cannot conceivably advance its climate goals while turning a blind eye to the clear cuts currently occurring and being planned on state lands. As supervising body of all forest management and policy in the state of Oregon, the board should explore the full extent of its authority granted by the Oregon legislature to develop an honest and transparent accounting of forest carbon and immediately begin the process of adopting science-backed climate smart management alternatives, beginning with the ending of clear cutting on all state forest lands. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Samantha. Up next is John.
Chair Anderson, members of the board, my name is John Talbert, president and senior economist for Center for Sustainable Economy and co-director of the Forest Carbon Coalition. On July 10, 2018, and again last month on May 6, we were joined by dozens of scientific, conservation, and community organizations in providing you a roadmap for embracing best available science, best practice, and sustainable economics in developing a forest carbon agenda for the state. Our forest lands are unrivaled in their ability to capture and store carbon, but only if we abandon the antiquated practices of clear-cutting and short-rotation timber plantations. As meticulously documented in our submissions, the science on this is crystal clear. These practices are the leading source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. They're presently uncounted in the official greenhouse gas inventory and are making the land more susceptible to climate change by increasing the risks of drought, disease, wildfire, floods, landslides, low summertime stream flow, thermal pollution, fish kills, regeneration failures, and harmful algae blooms. These are the resiliency issues Cindy raised. As such, a rapid transition away from business as usual practices must be front and center of this board's agenda, especially in light of Executive Order 2004. To comply with its requirements, specific measures outlined in our May 6th submission include halting any further logging of carbon-rich, native, and old-growth forests. This includes identifying and limiting such logging projects in state forests and use of your good neighbor authority to be advocates for this on federal public lands. Using direct regulation, incentives, and technical support to help expedite the transition to climate smart forest practices like long rotations, variable retention thinning, and other alternatives to clear cuts on private lands. Establishing forest carbon storage targets for all Oregon forest lands that reflect nature's baseline, the amount of carbon that is stored in the fragments of old-growth forests that remain, initiating rulemaking processes to eliminate harmful logging practices in drinking watersheds. Already, we've lost 50% or more of the annual water supplies as a result of these practices. Climate change will only add to this stress. Initiate rulemaking to regulate and reduce CO2 emissions from the logging and wood product sector. And finally, work with Oregon Department of Revenue to change subsidies so that they don't go to Wall Street and foreign investor-owned corporations, but go to small family foresters in Oregon who know how to log and leave a climate-resilient forest behind. You already have broad statutory authority and discretion to implement these measures, yet in ODF's May 15th submission to Governor Brown, not a single such measure was proposed. As a result, ODF will continue to work on false solutions advocated for by Peter Daugherty and his staff, such as forest carbon offsets, mass timber, cross-laminated timber, burning trees for energy, storing carbon in wood products rather than forests, and thinning projects in federal lands that actually make wildfires worse. This is unacceptable, and perhaps Mr. Daugherty is not the person to lead this agency as it strives to reorient its mission to be a leader on mitigating the effects of climate change. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, John. Up next, Maria.
Maria, are you able to unmute?
So I start again. Hello, my name is Maria Soss, and I am a resident of Lincoln County. I live in the Coast Range, and the topics of forestry and climate change have been in my mind, heart, and action for several years. We have been seeing privately owned forests clear-cut at an alarming rate, both in the size of cuts and frequency of harvests. Today, we face clear cuts wherever we go. Northwest forests used to be one of the world's largest carbon sinks. Even though trees are replanted after being cut, the new generations, all of the same species, raised with pesticides that kill the microorganisms in the soil and poison all new non-coniferous growth, do not regenerate the same ecosystems that existed, nor the same capacity of the forest to store carbon and emit oxygen. Today, Northwest forests have become one of the biggest carbon emitters in the world. Profits to be made from clear cutting and pesticide spraying drive the continuing destruction of forest land, and with it, the increasing scarcity of water, pollution of streams, and take place at the expense of health and safety of the people and of all forms of life that exist in our forests or near them. I hope the Board of Forestry is aware of the grave injustice to humans and non-humans alike of continuing extraction and replanting of Oregon's forests in the manner it is done today. There is work being done on carbon offsets as a way to increase carbon storage. That means that the reduction in CO2 emissions by some people can be used by others to pay for failing to reduce emissions. We do not have time for such gains, which inevitably inhibit the rate at which we could slow down the warming of our planet. Our window of opportunity to prevent catastrophic and irreversible climate change is small and getting smaller. We now have 10 years to change course. Trees must be allowed to grow to an age that gives them the ability to store carbon that truly counts. Most of today's trees grow thin and spindly. We desperately need those huge, centuries-old trees that timber companies are so eager to get their saws on to save our climate and keep our planet home livable for us and all other beings. Let us keep what we have left. It is precious. The Forest Practices Act can be reformed to do that. Forests have grown without pesticides for millions of years, creating the wealth of life and the wondrous ecosystems of which so few remain intact. We cannot restore or replace what nature took millions of years to make with chemical intervention or genetic modification. We have to protect what we still have of nature from further unraveling and destruction. It is we who need to adapt to nature, not the other way around. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. We have concluded our public comment period, Board Chair.
All right, thank you, and thanks for those who provided comments. So we are now back to the matter of a motion to move forward with the questions.
I apologize, Chair, to interrupt. There was one more, David Tweet. Okay. I apologize, David. Let me get you up.
No problem.
My name is David Tveit, T-V-E-D-T. I live in the Eugene, Springfield area. And most of what you talked about today was your authority and constraints on your authority. And considering, I think you all know that logging is the biggest single carbon emitter in Oregon. An OSU study confirmed that, and the Center for a Sustainable Economy also did. And considering that, I think it's really important you go beyond what your current constraints are and push for reform of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. That is the only way that you will be able to make much of a difference in that the carbon emissions from logging. The industrial model of logging is incredibly petroleum dependent. The fertilizers, all the heavy equipment, aerial spraying, the herbicides are made from petroleum, and of course flown by helicopters that use petroleum. All that is unsustainable, and it all needs to change, and you can be leaders in pushing the legislature to make changes, necessary changes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we've concluded. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Hillary. Okay, is there a motion on this issue?
I thought you made a motion, Tom.
No, I didn't make, I outlined what I thought would be a motion, but I wasn't proposing a motion. I generally
avoid that. Okay.
Remember to propose. So could be that, could be something else.
I think you were about to propose a motion.
Cindy's hand is up. Oh,
I'm sorry, there's a phone ringing in my background, so which I can't do anything about. So Cindy, I'll mute myself.
So I move that the six questions discussed earlier be submitted to DOJ for an answer to clarify what our current authorities and constraints are regarding climate change.
I second that as well, but I would also offer a friendly amendment that it be that the decisions be made with all due haste.
I'm perfectly happy with that modification to the motion.
All right.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification on that first question, we were going to have the question related to forest products that we discussed earlier, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And as I understand, the other modification was to include the question with respect to harvest and transportation carbon costs.
Whether you could regulate harvest and transportation cost or
whether you could consider it.
That, I don't know if that's technically a legal question. That's a methodological question in terms of how to calculate carbon.
No, it's not. It is a legal question in that can we use that information when we are assessing the net carbon costs associated with any policies around carbon stores?
Seems to me if we have a legal question of whether or not we can consider carbon storage in wood products or in trees in our rulemaking, we also have a legal question of whether or not we can consider carbon costs associated with harvest and transportation. And while I think the policy question before that will ultimately be before the board as to whether or not we want to, we might as well ask right now whether or not we have the legal authority to take that into consideration. I thought that was one of the modifications in the six.
Yeah, it is, Cindy.
I think that would be more of a separate question, whether you have the authority to track or consider transportation carbon and wood harvesting equipment carbon. But we can add that. We can incorporate that in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with that. I really see that as down the road. I mean, I think fundamentally it's just a question of whether or not forest products can be considered. I think that we can, go to that. I think that's the question really that we need to pose to Department of Justice, but.
Yeah, Joe, the reason I'm wanting to include that is I believe there was some discussion a couple of meetings back. I can't even remember where the comment came from, but it was the effect that, the carbon associated with transportation is not within our authority. That's in DOT's authority. So I think we need to find out whether or not that's something that is within our authority to consider. And I agree with you, Joe, the policy question of whether or not we to will come later. But we might as well now, since we're asking DOJ for answers, find out whether we have the authority to do so should the board decide they want to.
All right.
Okay. So we have clarification, right, on what the motion is, I think.
Correct.
So, we'll do another roll call vote.
Do you need a second?
I thought.
Seconded it.
Yeah, I think Brenda seconded it.
Yeah. Okay. Nils Christofferson.
Aye.
Cindy Deacon Williams.
Aye.
Kelly.
Aye.
Brenda McComb.
Aye.
Mike Rose.
Aye.
Joe Justice.
Aye.
And Tom Imeson is aye, so the motion carries unanimously. Thank you.